Welcome to the Dungeon Plunger Podcast. My name is Jason Weeb, and this is the show in which I, a real-life janitor and dungeon master, teaches you how to plunge in and run a better Dungeons & Dragons game. Without further ado, let's plunge into this week's episode. Necromancer versus Frog. Fight!
Hit it!
Dungeon Plunger Union members, I have my plus one plunger, a steaming hot cup of holy water blessed by St. Keurig, and I have a very special union member with me today to help plunge the dungeon and flush evil down the drain, Bill Webb. Bill is the co-founder of Necromancer Games and later founder of Frog God Games. He's responsible for bringing us the Mega Dungeon Rappanathic, the Sword of Air, and many, many more fantastic products. Welcome to the show, Bill.
Thanks, man. Appreciate it. Glad to be here.
Super, super stoked to have you. You've been, as we kind of spoke off air before, you were definitely my introduction to sort of the OSR before the OSR ever actually showed up and old school playing of games. So how about you tell us a little bit about yourself for some of the people who may not know who you are?
So when I was a little kid, I lived in a town that had a hobby store about 3 miles from my house, and I would ride my bike up there because I was then and am now a really avid World War II miniatures player. So I like tank battles and sandboxes, right? And I used to go up there when I was like 12 years old, and I would play tank battles with all the old World War II vets. These guys were, you know, guys my age now at the time. So this is in the mid-70s. And I was pretty good at it too. I could beat most of the old timers, which was kind of fun. One day I'm sitting in the hobby store and some guys were playing this game with one miniature and like toy blocks and dominoes and stuff. And I asked them what they were doing and they said playing Dungeons and Dragons. Well, so I went away for a youth group trip a few days later. With a guy named Rich Oliver, who you'll see his name in our credits as layout, and I'll get back to that in a minute. And a guy named Buck Williams, I think was his last name, and a guy named Steve Peterson. He was not Steve Peterson from Chaosium, but he is Steve Peterson, who went to Caltech and was one of the guys at Balboa that did the book Warlock, if you guys remember that. And then there was another guy that was a friend of ours named Scott Stabbert, another guy named Vic Armour, another guy named Kurt Ubel. And so we started playing D&D, and that's I started to learn. My very first adventure was in Teagle Manor. I played a first level cleric with no spell, right?
Wow.
It's kind of cool because I actually have the original Teagle Manor map drawn by Bob. I think some people have seen it in Goodman's big giant Judges Guild book or whatever that he gave me in the early 2000s when we were working together on Wilderlands and City State and that kind of thing. Bob Senior.
Okay.
And, but anyway, so, you know, I guess sort of the rest is history. We started learning, you know, there weren't any books, right? So there was White Box, and then the Monster Manual came out, I think the same year I started playing, which was 77. Dice were almost impossible to find and everything else, but we found them, you know, and I think it took me like 4 weeks of allowance and everything else to buy the dice. Cause they were like $15 a set back then. Only Luzo guy made them. And you had to mail order them and all kinds of stuff. And so we started playing D&D, and then a couple of guys went off to college, and the rest of us were there. And so the DM, who was Buck, had gone to college. So I became the DM because I was the youngest one. So they made me be the DM, figuring I think they could take advantage of me or something. And they learned the hard way that they couldn't. And so what spawned out of the early days of that was, you know, the white box rules tell you, you know, get a box, outdoor survival box, then you build this dungeon and you add more levels to it. And that was the origin of Rappanathic.
Oh, wow. Okay.
And so Scott, who's the guy who wrote Black Monastery back in the day, and I'll tell a quick story about that in a second, he was a commercial diver.
Okay.
And I worked for him, basically taking seaweed out of rich people's docks and removing cables from boats and stuff like that. And so I was sort of the deckhand and the muscle, I guess, behind moving large, heavy things. So I was a pretty strong kid and I was big. Anyway, so he would do my cartography for me. He and Rich did all the cartography for the maps. And And then we'd do it actually while we were on Scott's boat, where we were, you know, waiting for the, you know, the safety guy to approve him going down and into the pipe or whatever to, you know, clear the pipe out. He did some really scary diving stuff. He ended up being in the Navy and doing the same thing for them later.
Okay.
So I developed the first, I think it was 26 levels of Rappahannock, probably between 77 and 80 or 81. And most of that was done on a dive boat.
That's crazy.
You got a lot of downtime on dive boats. So that was sort of how that came to pass. And then the Sword of Air, the original pieces of that, I'm sure there were other people who were as well, but I was a really campaign focused guy, right? Like I wasn't all about just go dungeon crawl, die, roll a new character, that kind of thing. And so we played really with the kind of a long-term view of our characters and that kind of thing. And I know Rich had two or three characters that were, you know, for 5 or 6 years that were still around. And my friend Eric had the same. He had a magic user thief, I think, that was, long-term characters. And so then I ran off to college, went back to Virginia to college, met Clark and four other guys who were all in the same fraternity house. And it turned out that all five or six of us, I guess, were gamers. And then we added one guy from another fraternity. So then we had that group with the seven of us, so six players and me. And I had a whole bunch of notes because I used to write everything down. And most of those notes turned into what became Sword of Air while I was in college. And so we spent, you know, probably 5 days a week for 4 years playing D&D. Honestly, if we weren't chasing girls or drinking beer or doing homework, we were playing D&D. And that's where, if you've read some of my work, you'll see references to people like Spiegel the Mage and the Wearer of Purple Worms and Don't Go Down the Well and all the, because he used to use magical ink to like deface my dungeons, and that was and then Flail the Great was Dale's cleric, and Clark was Banner the Paladin, of course, because he had to be a paladin. And we were really into Ultima 4 at the time, playing, you know, that video game. And so I made him go through this whole series of quests, like the Lord British quests from Ultima 4, if anybody's old enough to remember that game. Get his paladinhood. And it was like, it took him like a whole year. I tortured the guy. And then Ian Thompson played Helman the Hobbit Thief. JP played, I can't remember the name of his character, but, he lives out here by me now. But he played a magic user of some sort. I don't remember exactly what, but the whole idea then was there were so few rules and that you didn't really know what the rules were. So you had to make them up. And so we spent a lot of time making up rules and house rules and figuring out how things worked. And I wrote everything down because I was really good about that. And then our senior year in college, Clark and I sat down with a typewriter because he could type really fast, right? I was a pretty slow typer, but he could type really fast. And this is before computers. And we typewrote all the levels of Rappahannock that I'd written. I just dictated and he typed. And then all the rules that we developed as house rules. And, then we went down to the mimeograph place and got the horrible ammonia smelling purple prints of these things. Took off the sets. So, you know, I kept playing D&D the whole time. Clark kept playing D&D the whole time, but we lost track of each other. And so that was, we graduated in 88 or 89, I guess, spring of 89, and we, from college, and then we went our separate ways. He went back to California. I came back out to Washington. And, then about 10 years later in 1999, I was down on a business trip, in Fountain Valley, California. And it reminded me that, hey, Clark lived in Fountain Valley, California. I hadn't thought about that for at least 6 or 7 years. And, so I tried to find him, and the Los Angeles phone book had like 80 Clark Petersons or C. Petersons in it, right? And this is back again in the day before the internet. I had no idea that he'd gone to law school. I know he was thinking about it, but I didn't know where he'd gone or whether he was a lawyer someplace. Anyway, so I called all 80 of them, completely struck out. None of them were him. Pissed a bunch of people, thought I was some sort of weird, you know, scammer or something. And so I couldn't find him. So the weird thing is the ESP going on with this, was I got home from that business trip and I got home at like 8 o'clock. I went to the bar that was like up the street from my, my house. I got back to my house into my office and I had a bunch of voicemails and so I popped my voicemail and no shit. There was a message from Clark Peterson trying to find me, not because he'd heard from C. Peterson down in Fountain Valley. He goes, I have cracked the code. They can't stop us from publishing for D&D. I have to be the lawyer. So I need somebody to actually be the head of the company that I'm representing. He goes, let's publish Rapid Athoc. He goes, and so I called him at 3 o'clock in the morning and woke him up. And he's like, oh my God, it's so great to hear from you. He goes, we can totally do this. And I'm like, are you sure? They sue everybody, man. I mean, their TSR stands for they sue regularly, you know? And he goes, no, he goes, we can totally do it. And he goes, don't worry about it. He goes, I've already drafted everything. We're going to submit it. We're going to send it to Wizards of the Coast. We're going to tell them we're doing this. They're going to send you a really scary letter. And all you have to do is fax it to me. That's again, how many years ago this was. Right. And then I'll take care of everything. So sure enough, I signed this thing. You know, we send it to Hasbro in Delaware. The next day, I get a certified letter basically saying, we're going to sue you. We're going to take your house. We're going to take your car. We're going to kill your children. I mean, it was terrible. Wow. And I called him up like, dude, what did you just get me into? Right. And he goes, don't worry about it. And then he handled it. And about 2 days later, I got a phone call from Delaware saying, we'll give you a license.
Okay.
And thus Necromancer was born. Cause he was right. And at the time, nobody understood that was actually common law in the United States. Everybody knew it was in England, but nobody knew about it. But basically they said, congratulations, you found our reverse track and, you can have a license. And so that was when we incorporated about 2 days later, making sure we had a corporate umbrella, because I insisted on that. Clark said we didn't need one, but I said, no, we're doing this, you know, and because I had that scary letter. At 12:01 a.m. the day they released 3.0, we released the first PDF of Wizard's Amulet. And I had already written R1 Crucible Freya, which was C1, I think, or something. And I'd already written Demons and Devils. I got inspired and wrote for like 30 hours in a row to write Demons and Devils. I just kept going. I was on fire. And anyway, so Clark was editing those. So he primarily did the editing and making, scientist Bill speak into liberal arts lawyer speak so that it sounded better and was grammatically correct and everything else. And, but I did probably 90% of the work on the writing.
Okay.
And then he did all the editing and rules stuff and everything else. The exception to that would be Tomb of Abasthor. He wrote like the first three or four levels of that. Okay. I wrote all the dungeon bits. He wrote all the stuff involving Balkoth and Dark Natasha. And I always did Wilderness, because Wilderness is sort of my thing. But anyway, so then we, published under Sword and Sorcery Studios as Necromancer from 2000, I think we released our first book, because the deal we made with Wizards was we would release it the same day they released the rules.
Okay.
And they, of course, gave us the rules ahead of time, which was kind of cool. Those things are worth a fortune now if you have one of the Xerox copies of the draft rule set. But
I believe it.
I have one someplace, I think. Then we published until fourth edition hit. And, that coupled with the 2008 recession, I went dark for a little bit. I bought all the back stock from White Wolf and from Kenzer and from Trollords, because I had three people publishing their books. I was writing faster and bringing in freelancers faster than White Wolf could keep up with on the schedule. Okay. And they wanted like one book a quarter. I was publishing 12 books a year. So we were really prolific.
Yeah.
Published some really good stuff and had some really good. I gave Mike Merles his first freelance job, actually.
Yeah. Was funny because I remember seeing, I think it was Durgham's Folly, mm-hmm. and it had this Mike Merles guy on here. And I was like, okay, who is this guy? And then all of a sudden he ended up
going. All of a sudden he's like the king of 5e, right?
So, yeah. I don't think people remember early days.
I've worked with almost everybody at one point in time in my life. I worked with Gary Gygax. I've done a little bit of work with Luke. I worked like obviously Steve Chenault, and I've worked on things together many times. Wolfgang Bauer is one of my closest friends. When I was working over in Bellevue, it's about a 2.5 hour commute from where I live.
Okay.
I was actually sleeping in his house 3 nights a week.
Oh, wow.
But I didn't have to commute for about 2 years. So he and I are pretty tight. And, you know, of course, Monty was in our studio and the Fire Dragon guys were in our studio. And,
okay.
And
yeah.
we even published a book for George R. R. Martin once.
Really? What was that?
Yeah, the Game of Thrones role-playing game was run through the Sword and Sorcery Studios.
Oh, okay, yeah.
Yeah,
so So one of the things that I always found kind of ironic is that you're an old school guy.
Mm-hmm.
You know, one of the motto of the company was first edition
field. Third edition rules, first edition field.
There you go. So, but yet you were publishing rules for a game that's probably the most diametrically opposed to your play style. So how did you feel about that?
And
how
did that happen? What would happen with this is I would write the adventure and then we had some really smart people who could make the rules work for it. They never could quite figure out how to make the illusion rules work the way that I use them. So like the Rakshasa encounter in Rappahannock on level 3, was never quite right in third edition. It doesn't lend itself well to actually rules because, you know, Rakshasas are illusion at will. What does that mean? You know?
Yeah.
But we had a guy named Scott Green and a woman named Erica Balsley. He used to go by her handle, was D&D chick. And I think Scott was, I can't remember. It was like Exo Romeo or something. And they were like super rule geeks. And so they both worked for us, along with Jeff Harkness, who's been our editor since, you know, forever. They, like I said, they take my adventures and they would do stat blocks and they do rules for it. They'd call me and ask me questions. Actually, they'd Microsoft Messenger me with a little paperclip guy about, you know, what is this supposed to do? How's this supposed to work? And then they'd come up with rules that fit that. I couldn't write for third edition rules to save my life. I couldn't write to fifth edition rules really very well. I would do it all wrong. But again, the MO for what we've done over the last 25 years is, all right stuff, and then we have a rules person make it work for the rules. Because they had me run some third edition games, and it was like, oh, you can do that. Oh, okay, yeah, sure, yeah,
yeah.
You know, I just made stuff up and pretended like I knew the rules. I absolutely didn't,
right?
Because I've run really a white box style game for my entire, you know, I guess 47 years of running games.
Yeah.
And so, you know, I could probably officially run anything, but I may not get the rules right.
Right. So in like 2007 and 8, around that time, that sort of became like the dark days of our hobby.
Yeah. So we shut down and I started selling old books on eBay. And, the thing is, when we shut down, and I wouldn't say we shut down because I kept the corporation alive and I did the K-1 form every year and I paid the taxes and everything else. But Clark and I each owned half of that. And so I had bought at my own expense all the manuscripts that I'd commissioned and all the artwork that I'd commissioned from the artists. I paid for them all because it wasn't the writer's fault or the artist's fault that we decided to not publish a book, right? And we decided we weren't going to do fourth edition. We didn't really know what we were going to do yet. But one of the manuscripts that I'd purchased was the Slumbering Tsar Saga from Greg Vaughn. And it was immense. It was like 800,000 words, right?
Yeah. You could kill somebody with that.
So I paid him a lot of money for that thing. And I think I only had the first installment of the 3. At that point, but I had given him a big check for the first piece. And, you know, my wife was ready to strangle me because, you know, I was paying personal money to pay these people. But anyway, so he contacted me. Actually, I can't remember if I contacted Greg or Greg contacted me, but I said, you know what? I go, you're all into this. I saw your name on this stuff with Pathfinder. You want to try and publish stuff for Pathfinder? And he said, sure. And so, you know, we called Lisa and asked if that was okay. And she said, of course, yes, please do. You know, And so on April 1st of 2010, I went to the old Necromancer boards, if you remember them, the chat boards, right?
I love those.
We're going to start publishing a game for this Pathfinder game. I don't know anything about it, but I got a guy who does. And we've got all these old manuscripts that never got published. And the first one we're going to do is I'm going to do this giant book, and we're going to do it as a print on demand on drive-through in chapters. And if we sell $25,000 of this thing, you know, then I'll actually figure out a way to make a hardcover book of it or something, you know. And it's called The Slumbering Tsar Saga. It's huge. It's, you know, 800,000 words of text. And we're going to release it, you know, but I got to get money up front, right? Because I got to pay people. And so I called Rick Sardena, who is, I wish I could show you that my camera won't reach, but I've got a couple of his oil paintings in here.
Okay.
And he was my cover artist for most of Necromancer. And I said, hey, Rick, I can't pay you, but I'll give you a percentage. And he said, you always paid me, Bill, sure, I'll do it. And I emailed Robert Altbauer over in Austria. And because he'd done a lot of cartography for me, and I was like, hey, Rob, you know, I want to do these. It's like 100 maps, man. And he goes, oh, yeah, standard rates. I'm like, no, I can't afford to pay you. So I'll give you a percentage. And maybe we'll do something. And he said, I'm in. And I called Chuck Wright down in Florida, who's Charles Wright, was our layout guy for most of Frog God before his health sort of failed him. And the same drill. I can't afford to pay you, but, you know, if you'll do all the layout and graphic design, I'll give you a percentage. So I think each one of those guys got about $30,000 or $40,000 for their contributions.
Wow, that's amazing.
And they all wanted to work on commission thereafter. And I was like, no, man, we're not doing that. So the punchline was this: everybody thought it was an April Fool's joke.
Really?
They all thought I was kidding. And I got on there all morning. I was like, no, we're not kidding. I'm really going to do this. If we get enough people, we'll do it. Here's the PayPal address. And then I went off to church. My wife and I went to church. We went out to brunch afterwards. It was a nice day in April. We went and hung out at the beach for a couple hours. I got back at about 4 o'clock in the afternoon, and there was $58,000 in the PayPal account.
Wow.
I remember looking at Krista and I go, oh, well, I guess we're starting our company back up again.
Yeah.
So I always claim I invented Kickstarter. So it was before Kickstarter existed. And I basically did a Kickstarter for Slumbering Tsar. And so at that point, you know, I've got other people's money and have to deliver something. So I got everybody, you know, on the phone and talked to them and said, okay, this is for real. We're doing it. You know, let's rock and roll. And I really had no idea how to do the logistics of any of the production of books past delivering a manuscript, right? And so I had to figure all that out. I had Steve Chenault helped me a lot with that. Because he had a little print shop at the time, and he hooked me up with the hardcover printer that we use and are going to be using on the box set that's coming out, Walsworth. Okay. Right. Absolutely top-notch quality. Kind of spendy, but if you want your book to be better than everybody else's book for a quality perspective, they're your guys.
Right.
They're not cheap. But I'll talk about the tariff thing at some point, I guess.
Okay.
Yeah. But anyway, so then I realized, well, I can't publish this under Necromancer, though, because Clark owns half of Necromancer.
Okay.
And he didn't want anything to do with the business anymore because he's in a very red state, super conservative, super religious area. And his opponent called him a demon worshiper because it was a thing. Like, it was important that he couldn't do that because he's an elected judge.
Right.
Has to run for re-election every time.
Yeah.
And so that, you know, being the demon worshiper doesn't sell well in Northern Idaho.
Fair enough. Anyway,
So I started Frog God, and we put the LLC together that day and submitted our paperwork to the Secretary of State on Monday morning, because it was a Saturday when I did this, and Sunday, you know, was when people actually believed me. and then we already had Slumbering Tsar done and Pathfinderized, because Greg had already done it for that. I think he tried to get them to do the manuscript, and they just said it was too big. They didn't want it.
Right.
Because he asked if I'd release rights, and I said, of course. But I had all these other manuscripts. So I put Greg on doing, like, convert this to Pathfinder. And he was just jamming them out. And then we started bringing in a few freelancers who were Pathfinder people.
Right.
Because I couldn't do it. But then we produced the giant monster book. For some reason, we like 800-page books. The Tome of Tome of Horrors.
Yeah, your products can really kill people.
Yeah, it's like, yeah, exactly. Yeah. And that thing will actually stop at 38, but it won't stop at 45, by the way. That's been tested. I have a gun range in my backyard. Okay. I live super rurally and nice. I'm 15 acres. But anyway, so we didn't know how to do anything with it other than I could print it and have it delivered to Paizo, and then they would sell it in their store. And we thought that was a great idea. And again, at about 10 o'clock in the morning, the day it released, Lisa called and said, I need more books. I'm like, I sent you 3,000 of them. And she goes, they're all gone. And I'm like, well, I don't have any money. You know, I wrote a check for $45,000 out of my personal account to the printer. Right. And she goes, call Jeff Alvarez, tell him what you need. We'll get it to you.
Wow.
And so they actually, but yeah, we sold out of that thing in like 2 hours.
That's amazing.
And yeah, I went and bought a new car for my wife and our youngest baby, because we needed a minivan. And because at that point we just had our second kid, we needed a minivan.
Wow.
And I wish things were still like that. They are for people like my friend Kelsey, right?
But yeah, they're not for us. For sure.
Now that was when there were almost nobody was publishing anything in 2010.
Yeah.
And so it was a very small group of folks that were doing things. Anyway, so then I was trying to figure out a way to do an OSR game, and I met Matt Finch via the internet. He actually contacted me. And I had in parallel had been researching which game systems were actually legal with the SRD.
Okay.
And I sent him to Clark because he was my only lawyer buddy only when he worked for free, right? And he said, well, this one is breaking the rules. This one's breaking the rules. This one's breaking the rules. He goes, whoever wrote this Sword and Wizardry one really knows what they're doing.
Right.
And so I was trying to locate him, and he contacted me. I said, hey, I really just want to write books. I don't want to do all the business side of this stuff anymore. What do you think about, you know, let's partner up in that. And we did for a number of years, for, I guess, 12 years we were together. The unfortunate thing was, as our company grew, Matt had to do all the business stuff again, and he didn't want to do that. And yeah. So I totally get that. I miss having him around, but he's doing his own thing. He's being really successful. He's a hell of a nice guy, and he does great work. And I'm pleased that I got to work with the guy for over a decade. But then the good news for me, because I had been working on my own game system.
Right.
I didn't finish the one thing about Frog God. I had to start Frog God so that Clark had no interest in it, and so we could have a second thing. And that comes from Clark Ashton Smith, Sathaga, Hyperborea.
Right.
I've been Froggy or Sathaga back to when there were things called MUDs. There were multi-user dungeons, online chat games, and I was always Froggy. I play Lord of the Rings online. I've been playing since the closed beta on it, and my main character's name is Froggy. So anyway, I got a thing for frogs. So we made a deal. We started publishing Sword and Wizardry books. All my legal, including Matt, who was also a Harvard lawyer, assured me that we were good on that. Nobody ever messed with us about it, so apparently we were. And I tabled my own game system because I had already written about, I had all my college notes, and then I sort of updated it to modern times.
Right.
I'd written about two thirds of what my rule system was all about. But I didn't ever make it because we had Swords and Wizardry. So, why do that? Right. And it was close enough of a game, that it was fine. And, it was fine. Anyway, so Matt and I, Matt went off and started his own company here three years ago, I guess. So I'm like, all right, boys, and girls, because we've got a couple women as partners too.
Yep.
We're going to publish my rule system. And of course, everyone's like, well, all that we need in the world is another OSR system. And I'm like,
right.
I don't really care. I'm the CEO and we're freaking going to do it, that's where. And I'll get to that, and we can talk about the Kickstarter a little bit in a minute, and my Patreon too, because you can join my Patreon for free, by the way. So you don't even have to pay me anything unless you want to. That's basically where we're at now. I pulled the beta rule system out and published a few of them at GaryCon a couple years ago.
Okay.
It's a kind of a rare book that'll probably might be worth something someday. Who knows? It looks like this. So it's just the base rule set. I think I made 66 of them or something. And people really seem to like it. We started playtesting it then, and then we've been, you know, I've got a pretty brutal set of playtesters. You'd mentioned earlier, like Zeb Cook and Helen Cook, his wife, have been playtesting my rules for me on every other Sunday for the last 3 years. My kids, who've been playing D&D since they could talk, and are pretty sharp. My daughter's in nursing school. My son's in electrical engineering school. They've grilled the hell out of me and made sure that the rules worked and that the balance between the classes was there and that kind of thing. And then I've run games at conventions for, well, using my rules really for 20 years. But people just didn't realize it because the rules weren't formalized.
Okay.
And so, what my rule system is, and this is on the Kickstarter that we were talking about earlier, I'd call it almost an advanced white box set. And so because I had to play white box when I was young, because that was all that existed. And I was too young to have brown box, but I'm not even sure Seattle got brown boxes, honestly. They might have all been sold in the Midwest. I bought my rules at Nordstrom, of all places, because they had it for sale at Christmas that year. You know, we had to make up rules, or we had to use other sources for rules. And I was heavily inspired by the Warlock rules. So I had thieves in my game before thieves existed, because they were not what you see today in thieves, but they were a thief class that Balboa Games in 76, I guess, introduced. I'm told by Bill Meinhardt that that's the first thief class. Somebody else claims they were, and I've got a copy of that book too, but I think the Warlock rules are older. And then we had Ardwin, of course, the original three Ardwin books. And we had, by about 1980, we had the Game Lord stuff, which was, you know, Free City of Haven and that kind of thing, which were really, had some really good snippets. But so what I sort of did between that and Rollmaster and, you know, other things is I sort of parsed together my own rules from stuff that I liked or stuff that made sense, with the key factor being I never wanted to have anybody roll more than two dice to adjudicate anything, because then it slowed the game down.
Right.
And one of the things people ask, you know, me all the time is, how do I run games for 15 or 20 people? And it's because it's so simple to figure out whether you can do something or not. And you don't always have to roll dice. If it makes sense, then right. Let it work. You think there's a chance of failure, make a roll. But there really are several mechanics that I've developed that are simple, but make sense. And the first one is what I call parlay checks.
Okay.
Anybody who's really played in an OSR game knows that you die a lot and you don't really want to fight stuff. And, you know, the concept of law versus chaos and all that other stuff, there's no reason the goblin wants to kill you if you're going to kill three of his friends before they kill you. They want to live too, right? You know, there's no reason that the moose is going to stomp you if it's you're not threatening its pup, right? And or calf, I guess, in the case of a moose. And so the parlay rules are in there. I've developed them to the point that I understood them, and then I turned them over to Jeff and to Edwin and to Zeb, and they helped me make them make sense to normal humans that don't just haven't been playing it that way for so long. And it's a really simple system, and I'm really proud of that.
Okay.
And what it does do is it makes it so I'm not sure if I could really say this, because I'm not sure it's true, but I'm one of the very first white box DMs, I think, that doesn't play a murder hobo game.
Interesting.
Oh, you get almost no experience for combat. You know, if you negotiate with things, you can make friends with them. If you look into like Rappanathuk, you'll see snippets of that where, you know, like Max the Otyug, right?
Right.
People, you make friends with him. None of the other monsters go there because it smells so bad. You got a safe place to camp.
Okay.
You know, go into the Goblin City and you aren't mean to the goblins. You have a, you know, trading post set in the Underdark, you know, stuff like that. And that's always the way that I've played. Has been, like I said, really focused on a long-term campaign and not just on killing monsters and stealing their stuff. And so that's one of the real innovations I think I have here.
Okay.
The other ones I
just want to stop you for 2 seconds. I mean, you're just full of stuff here that I just wanted to touch on. I'm pretty excited.
This is finally getting done.
Yeah, I can tell. And that's awesome. I'm super stoked myself. So first of all, you were talking about, because I do want to talk about the Kickstarter.
Yep.
So we already kind of dived into that a little bit. That's called the Necromancer's Game, which I guess takes its name from the company.
Yeah, it'll look, it does. It takes, it, it'll look, it'll, the cover will look like this, except for it'll be a hard cover and it'll be nice instead of a little, you know, custom print job thing I had 60 copies made of.
Okay. So you say, so you're talking about Dave Zeb Cook, who was the guy who was the rules creator for AD&D second edition.
Yep.
So how did you meet him?
Okay. So well, I met him back in like a Gen Con in like 2001 or whatever. Right. And we kind of hit it off and, you know, we both like fancy scotch and he's a nice guy. And I, he was one of my heroes. So of course, you know, I was like sucking up to the dude. Anyway, at Gary Con 3 years ago, I think, I'm an admin. I mentioned earlier, I played, you know, miniature war games. Right. And I'm an admin for the South Puget Sound Gamers thing on our Facebook site. Cause you know, we have a pretty sizable club, a couple hundred people, and, you know, and we all go down to Tacoma, which is about an hour for me to drive. Most of them live down there. Cause they're all soldiers that live on Fort Lewis for the most part. But, anyway, I got a request from a David Cook to join the South Sound Gamers Club. And I looked at his profile and I'm like, that's Zeb, man. He lives in Baltimore. What the hell? So I called him on my cell phone. We were both at the convention. I said, where are you at? And he goes, oh, I'm in the such and such room. And I'm like, why didn't you just ask to join my game club? And he goes, what game club? The one in Tacoma? And I go, yeah. And I go, he goes, oh, yeah. He goes, Helen and I bought this waterfront property in this little bitty town on the North Peninsula called Paulsbow. And I said, oh, you mean that teeming metropolis where I live that's got 10,000 people in it? And he goes, do you live in Paulsbow? And so by just strange, weird coincidence, Helen and Zeb decided to move to the middle of nowhere, like where, you know, Anne Rice says the vampires live because we don't have that much sunshine. but they moved out here and then they'd rented a place down in Tacoma. And then they're building their house. And their house is actually, I think the framing's all done as of like, I'll get new pictures today when he shows up for the game. But yeah, so it was just weird, freaky coincidence that, like I said, that I think there's 9,800 people in the town.
Wow. That's crazy.
I'm not even in the incorporated part of it. I'm 4 miles out of the city limits, but it's a really tiny little place. So that was almost 4 years ago, I guess. And we've been playing, you know, twice a month or three times a month game ever since.
So does he give you like a hard time going like second edition was the best D&D ever? And
No, he's actually, I'm being sarcastic. He's actually super respectful of he's definitely the old school. The DM is right. You know, if you disagree with something, tell him, but you know, don't expect it to change.
Yeah.
He runs we do a little mini convention at my house with a bunch of my friends from all over the country. Once a year, everybody comes out here and we spend a week playing games and eating expensive food and drinking expensive wine. And
nice.
And, Zeb usually runs either, a Boot Hill game or, an AD&D, what's the island with all the dinosaurs on it. The next one.
Isle of Dread.
Yeah, Isle of Dread. Oh, that's cool. And you know, he eats everybody with sharks and I blow up things with dynamite and piss him off. It's a really nice relationship. And his wife, Helen, is just lovely.
That's amazing.
She destroyed level 9 on the Rappanathic with a rock to mud last week. And it kind of pissed me off, but you know, she was
okay. Smart. So you're still playing Rappanathic.
Oh yeah. We're playing
Rappanathic. Wow. Okay. So just, again, there's just so much to unpack here. So you were also, we were talking a little bit about it off the camera, but you've also become friends with Kelsey Dion of Arcane Library.
So my friendship with Kelsey is professional only, really. I mean, I congratulate her when something cool happens to her, but I mean, she's such a rock star and she's such a really nice human that, you know, if you meet her, you're going to really like her. And I was lucky enough where she actually liked my stuff and had read a lot of my books and that kind of thing and played in a Judges Guild campaign with Rob Conley for years. So she's really legitimate old school, even as young as she is. I think she's in her late 30s. So we're buddies and we, you know, like I said, I cook her dinner when she goes to Gary Con because I'm allergic to sunflower oil and they cook with sunflower oil there. So I have to have a kitchen.
Okay.
And then I'm also a fairly accomplished chef. So
oh, wow.
I cook, I'm going to start doing dinner in a show, I think, for my games at that show.
That's awesome.
Because my players all show up and we feed them anyway, because I always make way too much food. But we usually have dinner for 12 or 15 people at that show, because I get a suite with the kitchen.
Okay. So fast forwarding now back to the Kickstarter. Mm-hmm. So is this coming out under Necromancer Games?
Yeah, it's Necromancer. Okay. So we have both imprints. And to explain that real easily is because we bought Clark out later.
Right.
And so he's no longer part of the company. And I bought out his interest in the company. So Frog God Games does everything associated with the Lost Lands, which is our home campaign setting, that tiny little, 800 page campaign. It was based on my original campaign, which I have the original map for, but my wife's cool enough to let me keep it by the dining room table, which is kind of neat. Of course, it looks a little different because I had all kinds of intellectual property violations on the one that we drew back in 1979 or whatever. But it's got Tolkien references and stuff like that. But so everything associated with the campaign setting, which is most of the adventures, not all of the adventures, but most of the adventures, a couple of the source books like the Tome of Artifacts, which we'll be releasing in a couple of months, is heavily focused on the Lost Lands setting. And so Rappanathuk is a Lost Lands book. The Tome of Adventure Design, that's Matt's. The Tome of Treasures, for example, is a generic book, not associated with the Lost Lands. So that becomes a Necromancer product.
Okay.
So a rule set would automatically go into Necromancer imprint, because that's our use it with anything stuff. Not that you can't use Lost Lands products in Greyhawk if you wanted to, because I know a lot of people who do, but they are focused on the canon and the lore of the setting.
Okay.
And so I think we've produced, last I checked, I think we have about 840 individual SKUs.
Wow.
Of different products. And so probably 2/3 of those are Lost Lands oriented and the rest aren't. But of course we didn't figure out this break in product lines. So there's some variance in the earlier stuff.
Yeah,
would be a good way to put it.
That's fair. So talk a little bit about like the Kickstarter. What are you getting in the box and.
Yeah. We're almost at $50,000, which is good. And then the one I wanted to just address the tariff issue real quickly, and then I'll talk about what's in it. We are printing it at Walsworth. In my humble opinion, they're the finest printer in the United States. They're very expensive to print with. That being said, they also use all US made materials. So Steve Chenault prints there for a reason, and I'm moving some of our printing there for a reason, which is that there's no chance of supply chain disruption. Okay. They're not using Canadian paper or ink from Japan or anything like that. And just because how uncertain and messy that situation is right now, I don't like taking other people's money. And it's still, in my opinion, it's still other people's money until that thing arrives in their mailbox.
Okay.
And so I don't want to take any risks with that. So as part of the reason the price is as high as it was, I had to up the prices because my print costs almost doubled over our other quotes were. But there's almost zero risk that I won't get the thing made on time and to the specs that I wanted. I've used Walsworth a lot. They did all the printing for our original giant books.
Okay.
So like Slumbering Czar, you can pick it up, shake it by the cover, it won't break, that kind of thing. Mm-hmm. So what's in the box set is 3 books, which will all be stitch bound, Smythe sewn hardcovers. And I'll get to that in a sec. Then there's going to be a giant poster map of the thing I'm most proud of the entire box set. And then there's going to be an adventure in it that is a starter adventure that sort of, it's a how to run the thing, right? And that adventure is going to be, I'm not going to reprint that adventure. It'll be available as a PDF later, but it's only in the box set. And so if you're a collector, you probably want to get the box set.
Okay.
So the first book is the Player's Handbook. And that's the one that's sort of the rules, right? So that's going to be all the rules that you need to play the game. And it explains all the combat. It explains the parlay system. It explains the lore checks. I'll talk more about lore checks in a minute. It explains the morale rules and that kind of thing. That's another one that I'm really happy with. I'll talk about in a minute. And it has all the character classes. Well, it has all of the standard character classes, which there are 11.
Okay.
And, and how experience points work and that kind of thing. So you can actually play the game with just this book. Well, this is an outdated version of it with bad grammar and Bill speak instead of Edwin and Jeff corrections. And then the second book then is a monster book. It's the best, the big one. I think it's got about 250 individual monsters, all specced to a white box rule system. And there's some creative stuff in there, like some of the Cthulhu beasts that are showing up on the artwork that we got. And I'll talk about art in a minute. And then the third book is the Game Master's Guide, which I can't call Dungeon Master's Guide, of course. But
of course.
But that one is composed of a lot of advice and discussion of how to run a hex crawl, how to run dungeon crawls, how to run city adventures, what things are available and what size of cities, and then lots of game theory and design advice for the first maybe third of the book. And I'm pretty proud of that. It's got a lot of advice that's been given to me over the years by people like Gary Gygax and Zeb Cook and Matt Finch, who's, in my opinion, one of the finest game masters I've ever seen play. And then, you know, I've run a game or two. Anyway, so there's that. That's all part of the Game Master's Guide. And then the really guts of the Game Master's Guide, though, are the treasure tables and the magic item tables and the encounter tables. The encounter tables I could talk about for a week, so I'll try and keep it brief. But the magic items are all specced out to the game. I introduce mundane magic items like, you know, a broom that sweeps the room by itself, or a blanket that keeps you warm in the wilderness, and little stuff like that, as kind of part of the treasure. And then I provide details of gems and jewelry and all that other stuff. It's where, you know, I give examples of all this stuff, and there's like multiple pages on that. These aren't short books. They're all well over 100 pages.
Okay.
And then then you get to the encounter tables. This is where my Mr. Burns comes out. So my son and daughter and I were always big fans of the first edition DM guide encounter tables. And we Xerox them out of the book so that they weren't playing with the $200, you know, first print or something.
Yep.
And then we use those for our game. But Jillian was like, Dad, she goes, why don't we put all the monsters in one of these? And I'm like, okay. And so she's the bartender at the local bar. And my son and I went up and we sat down on a Monday afternoon for about 3 hours when it was really slow. It was pretty much just us plus one or two other people in there. And developed encounter tables by monster rarity and biome. Okay. So a sphinx doesn't appear in the swamp. It's in the desert. You know, a vampire doesn't appear in the high mountains or whatever, you know, like, well, they probably do. It's about 45 pages of encounter tables that look very similar to the first edition DM guide, encounter tables, but they incorporate all of the base monsters from the monster manual, including, and they're sorted by rarity and biome. So, we did a master table of it. And then I broke it into pieces so it would fit in a book. But the poster that's in the box set is that master table. And so it's going to be like 4 feet by 5 feet or something.
Oh, wow.
But it has all of the encounter tables for, you know, because I could do it on a poster where I couldn't do it in the book, right? It says, you know, it has, you know, the list of 250 monsters going one way, the list of all the different, you know, mountains, hills, scrubland, plains, river valleys, blah, 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 going across this way. And then the percentages of all that stuff in it.
Okay.
So that's the monsters, though. Where I think we really got innovative with the encounter tables is, and this is my son's idea, and it worked out great, is he's like, Dad, what about not monster encounters? Like, couldn't you fall into a pit in the wilderness? Or couldn't you find a village? Or find an oasis in the desert? Or... So we developed all those types of things. And again, with probabilistic rarities by biome. So about the first 500 or 600 on D1000 tables of the entries are monsters or men or something that you encounter that's an entity. The rest of it, you might find ancient ruins. You might find, like I said, an oasis in the desert. You might find a city in the middle of nowhere that no one knows exists or something. And so it's really attenuated for hex crawl type campaigns, but could really be used for any kind of wilderness travel. And I provide at least, I think, 20 examples in the Game Master's Guide of each one of those things as sort of starter examples. And, you know, I name them and give them a paragraph detail. And so, you know, basically if you roll a village, you know, you encounter a village of dwarves that has a hidden, you know, silver mine that blah, 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 blah. And, you know, a couple hundred words about that. And so obviously it's not, the game masters are going to have to come up with more examples than what I provide in the book, but that should get you through a couple of years.
Wow. You know? Okay.
Fair. And, And so it's, I'm really proud of those encounter tables though. They are, everyone thought I was nuts. All my business partners, particularly Zach, gave me crap about it because he's like, it's going to be 40 pages. I was like, yeah, it's going to be 40 pages. You know, and it was like, well, you have to provide examples of all this stuff. And I'm like, oh God. So that took, you know, 60 hours of writing to do that, but I did it. And they're really neat. But anyway, so those, that's what's in the box set. And then the adventure is, it's about a, I don't know, 30 page adventure or so. And what I've done with that, is I wrote kind of a hex crawl plus a dungeon at the end.
Okay.
And as you would suspect as a starter adventure. But what I've done there is I pulled excerpts from the rules to illustrate how everything works as examples. And so it's, if you, you know, a guy, so you can pick this thing up and run the game with it, and it would be almost seamless because you could see how the rules work in specific circumstances. And I tried to include most of the rules. They're not all in there, but I tried to include most of the rules in it to show how they work. Then the other, the add-on pack. So most of the people have been buying kind of the all-in thing on this, right? You get an extra book, two books actually, I think. And what that consists of are six additional classes, which is the witch, the necromancer. They everyone wanted me to do a necromancer, surprise, surprise. Mm. So I did a witch, a necromancer, a goblin, and a lizard man, and a barbarian, and something else, illusionist.
Okay.
And those classes were selected based on folks on my Patreon giving me feedback with what classes they wanted.
Okay.
And it was universal that everyone wanted the necromancer. And then a lot of people asked for the witch.
Okay.
And oddly enough, shitloads of people asked for goblin.
Hmm.
They all wanted a goblin. So there's a goblin character class.
So this is like class, racist class type of
thing. Yeah, racist class. Yeah. So dwarves are dwarves, elves are elves. Everybody needs the same experience points to go up. So you go 2, 4, 6, 8, 16, 32 on up. And we balanced all the classes. Zeb gives me endless crap about how powerful the witch is. And I had to nerf the witch back a little bit because, you know, he said, why would I ever play a wizard? The witch is too good. And he does play a wizard, so you know he was particularly snarky about it.
Fair.
And then the other piece that's in that add-on pack is what my friend Michael Potter, he's the CFO of Corsair Software, and he likes to play D&D like he's a murder hobo. Like the dude is a murder hobo, and he'll ask me before my convention games because he signs up for. He's like, is this going to be? Do I get to fight stuff, or is this going to be one of Bill's Mensa tests? And so the adventure I wrote is called I can't remember the final name that the editor put it to, but I called it Blood Moon. I think it's called Blood Moon Rising, but it's a race against the clock to stop something really bad from happening. And yes, it's sort of a Mensa test. It's a few combats, lots of puzzles, lots of information gathering, pretty much stock and trade my style of adventure. Okay. If you've read Sword of Air, you know, I like thinking players, and I actually think it's some of the best work I've done in years. The Blood Moon adventure, it just turned out exactly with what I wanted, and actually they should hit the boss fight today in our game at noon.
Nice. So are you more of a the impression I'm getting is you're more of a, like a player skill over.
Very much. You don't want to fight stuff in my games. I don't, like I said, I am absolutely not a murder hobo style DM. And if you've read Rappahannock and Sword of Air, you know, if you go in swinging, man, you're going to get killed. You know, you're far better off dropping the rock from 200 feet up on the dragon's head than you have been fighting the dragon.
Right.
Or, setting an ambush, you know, where, an avalanche comes down on top of your opponents, or scaring stuff away using creepy, spooky spells. The first wizard spell that everybody takes when they hit seventh level in my game is Mass Morph, because it allows them to completely avoid encounters and rest. When Zeb's wizard hit seventh level here about 2 months ago, he took Mass Morph, very first spell.
Okay.
And, you know, not Ice Storm, not Polymorph Self, he took Mass Morph.
Okay.
Because you don't want to fight wandering stuff. You don't want to fight something unless you have to. And so, yeah, I try to have it where, like I said, I believe in a long-term campaign. I believe I like having lots of players, And so you have to have really simple rules to do that. And I like to see, I like to have the players do the storytelling, you know, so they tell me what they want to do. And then I react to that. And, you know, guys like Michael, well, he wants to go bash orcs over the head with an axe. But most of my players are pretty cerebral. They fight stuff. I mean, they fight stuff every session. They fight something, just about every session. Actually, my Wednesday night online game, they went two whole sessions with no combats because they were able to negotiate their way through stuff. They made friends with the kobold tribe and they've been trading them metal weapons for bags of scorpions. But what, yeah, kobolds didn't want to fight, you know, they didn't want to fight the kobolds because there were a lot of kobolds.
Right.
And so they managed to parlay and negotiate and they got a good bard player in there who did a really fine job of convincing the kobolds that, you know, people were friends, not food, I guess. And we won't hurt you. And by the way, you guys are fighting with stone weapons. We can give you these, you know? And so they were able to kind of develop a trade relationship, which is kind of
interesting. So when you're talking about the map, the poster map that's in the box.
Yeah.
So it's like the encounter tables and stuff are on one side. Is there like,
no, it's just, it's meant for, it's, and the reason we sell extra, we're selling extras of those outside of the box sets because collectors are never going to want to put it on their wall. Right. But if you're the DM, you can put your poster map right there. And while you're rolling your encounters, you can just go D1000 and look, and you've got your encounters figured out.
Is there like a hex map on the other side or
I might put hexagons on the other side. Yeah. I mean, okay. I don't know.
It's mainly just for the tables.
Yeah. I think one of the later stretch goals, which I doubt we're going to hit, would be, you know, put hex paper in the thing or something inside the box set. But you can get hex paper. It's easy enough to get, and you can download it for free on the internet. So, you know, why kill a tree? But it's, yeah. But anyway, so that's what's in the box set and the add-on pack.
Okay. Is it just out of curiosity, like in terms of like tariffs, because like I live in Canada, so is it considered to be a game, like, or is it going to be considered to be a book?
Well, based on the tariff situation, I consciously decided to not put dice in the box.
Okay.
That being said, I talked to a friend of mine who just got murdered by tariffs a couple weeks ago on a book. So it is at the discretion of the customs officer.
Okay.
And so the exemption, is for what they term literature, which should be, I mean, you know, this book was tariff exempt that I just got from New Zealand, right? Why they decided it was tariff exempt, couldn't tell you, but they did. And so when Battlefront shipped me my, you know, Pacific War update for fourth edition or whatever, for Flames of War, it came in and had no tariffs. That being said, I talked to a friend, and I won't say who it was just because I don't want to talk about other people's business directly, but I talked to a friend of mine last week who had a book show up from China. It was a D&D book, and he got whacked with 145% tariffs on it.
Damn. Yeah, that sucks.
So it's at the discretion of the customs.
Okay. People,
which is sort of like playing Russian roulette.
Yeah.
So if, you know, that's, we have a book coming from China right now that was done before all this happened and before all this weirdness started to go on the trade war. I got to give my printer a lot of credit, because they were willing, I owed them money, but I said, you know, I can't pay you because it's, we're in a trade war. And I said, do you agree? This is what's called a force majeure event. And they said, yeah, we agree. It's not just a customs issue. It's a trade war. So you don't technically, the contract's null and void if you want it to be. And I was like, well, you guys already printed this stuff. I gave him a down payment, so they're not out any money. And the guy said, you know what? He goes, let's make a deal. He goes, we're going to ship it to you. And if it comes in with a 10% tariff, we'll pay the tariff and then you pay us. We're just deducted from what you owe us. And if it comes in with 145% tariff, we're going to shake hands, part friends. When all this shit's over, we'll do more business together.
Right.
And so I was really impressed with the printing company. It's Lion Pendragon. I'll say their name straight out loud because I was really impressed with how they handled it. And it was really professional with them. They get that there's no way. I mean, if they ship me a book and I owe them 15 grand and it cost me 45,000 to do it, we'd be out of business. The Kickstarter only did like $40,000, right? So, you know, and that's before the artists and the writers and the, you know, editors and the, you know, all that got paid. So our margins on the thing are not that great. So for the foreseeable future, we're going to be printing in the United States. just because, like I said, I don't want to take any risks with other people's money.
Yep. No, that's fair.
So, whether or not that's going to, I mean, whether that's going to hurt you in Canada, where in Canada are you?
I'm in Montreal.
Okay. So yeah, you're not just driving across the border. So
yeah, no.
If you're in British Columbia, you probably could, because I'm pretty close to BC.
Oh, okay.
And you never know, maybe I can run it up to a friend in BC and they can ship them there. I mean, we do go to Victoria every now and then.
Okay. Oh, nice.
Yeah. But it's a direct ferry from over kind of where I live that takes you right to Victoria Island, which is pretty neat.
Yeah, it's a beautiful country. Yeah. Beautiful part of the country.
But whether or not you're gonna get hit with 10% or more, I don't know. I think we're back to, with Canada, are we back down to a straight 10% though?
I think there's 10% on non-USMCA compliant stuff.
Okay.
But who knows what's going on.
Yeah. So I don't, it's going to be up to the Canadian customs guy, right?
Yeah.
At that point. So I have no idea. I've shipped a lot of stuff to Germany and a lot of stuff to Rome and a lot of stuff to Norway and Finland. We have one guy in Finland who orders everything we ever make, but we only ship it to him once a year.
Oh, wow. Okay.
That way he doesn't pay, you know, $125 every time. He pays $250 once.
Okay.
And he's had no issues with paying import fees. What do they call it? VAT tax or whatever, because it's books. And he had me ship him the Swords and Wizardry box set separately because he knew he'd have a VAT on that. But we had dice in that box though.
Yeah. Yeah, that's just kind of move. Did you have other stuff that you wanted to share about the Kickstarter? Yeah,
I mean, I guess because the box set, obviously we're double funded at this point. We're into stretch goals. I really want to get to $60,000 because then Steve Chenault has to write a module, and we don't pay each other to write stuff. I wrote one for his Kickstarter a little while ago. I've done that a couple of times, but he owes me one if we hit $60,000, which I think we will. We've got 2 weeks left.
Okay.
I don't know if we hit 50 or not. We were like 49.5 this morning or something. I think that if whether you're a fifth edition gamer or an OD&D gamer or a third edition gamer or a Swords and Wizardry gamer or a Osric gamer or whatever it is, I think that there's enough material in this thing that'll be useful that you could, you know, you'd have to ignore book one, right? If you weren't playing an OD&D game. But the other two books have got some really interesting monsters in them, and the DM guide I think is I intend it to be globally usable. Right. So if you're playing Shadow Dark, you could take the entire third book, and for that matter, with Shadow Dark, you could take the entire second book, and they'd be compatible. The first book is the rules, and they would vary. I tried to make the and I haven't talked about lore checks yet, but I tried to make the extended rules, which are lore, morale, and parlay rules. And lore is sort of like a global catch-all for skills and investigations and learning things and knowing things, you know. But it's really clear and really easy and fast to use. I would encourage everybody to go on the Kickstarter, and I think there's an example of play.
Okay.
And there's also a quick start guide that are free to download.
Oh, wow. Nice.
And so, yeah, I mean, I want everybody to see this thing. It's going to be complete. The rules are going to be completely open source. I'm not going to make it where everybody, if you want to publish a module using my rules, yay. And so we're working on the license for that right now. Cause of course you have to insulate yourself against losing your copyrights and against getting sued because somebody did something with your rules. But we're working on that. And it is going to be open source. I think there's something here for sort of everybody, but you can go take a look. You know, if you want to know how to run a game with 20 people, this is it. It's a really good system to use for that. Works fine with 3, works fine with 20. And, I don't know if any of you watching or if you have ever seen either videos or me live running games at conventions, but, people marvel about the fact that there's 25 people in the room and everybody's engaged. And with 15 or 20 people, a melee round takes about 2 minutes with the rules. Yeah, it's only 2 dice rolls maximum. I mean, the only time you're rolling 2 dice most of the time is when you're rolling to attack and damage.
I've seen you do the barefoot standing on the table.
Yeah, I'm getting too old for that. You know, it's my warranty expired. You know, I'm an old man now. My son's been doing the table standing lately.
Okay. I was just curious, is this something that going forward, your products are going to be coming out supported absolutely. By this?
Yeah. And we haven't decided whether I'm just going to be doing it myself or whether they're going to be coming out through the company. because it's going to be adventures. I'm just going to write short adventures and hex crawl stuff. If anybody wants to, like I said, you can join my Patreon, which is free. There are paid levels on it, but you don't have to pay me anything if you don't want to. I will get this to you and then you can post it. Let me see Messenger. I know I used to sort of configure out how to do this sometimes. It's like a chat, right? So control B, there we go. So yeah, I just texted you my Patreon. I do a lot of stuff on there and I ask for input. I think it's at that, like the $5 level or whatever, you get the adventures. And I've been doing between one and two adventures a month. They're usually about 10,000 words or something. But I've been writing like a monster. I didn't do the Patreon because I get $300 a month from doing a Patreon. I did the Patreon because it makes me write every day or else I'm a jerk.
That's awesome.
And so it's a motivator for me. And yeah, the $300 it'll pay for my beer for the month. Right. But, I hope more people would want to do it. And I did put some pretty exclusive stuff in there for a couple of the levels, but again, nobody should feel obligated to spend one red cent on the thing. You can join it for free. You won't get the adventures, or at least most of them. But you won't get the probably someday valuable, you know, single press printing of the compilation of the adventures at the end of the year. But it won't cost you anything and you'll see a lot of what I'm working on and you'll get a lot of, I guess, free stuff. Because I do post things on there. You know, I posted up the extra character classes and I asked for input from my patrons. So everybody got to see the witch early after I got crucified by Zeb and the boys for making it too powerful. Like I said, I took input for what character classes do people want to see. And the reason the character classes are the ones they are for the extended classes is because my patrons and my players, sort of a combination of those, said, we want to see this, 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 and this. I'm still marveled by how many times the goblin came up. I wasn't expecting that.
That's funny. I'm definitely going to have a link for the Kickstarter, your Patreon, and Frog God in the show notes. So people will be able to access that right away. We've been talking for like an hour.
Like I said, my game doesn't start for another 45 minutes. So I got a few more minutes. If you got anything else you want to talk
about. One of the things that I've always wanted to talk to you about is Rappanathic and how you run it in the, so it started in the Wilderlands, right?
So my game world when I was a teenager was where we really started running the long-term campaign, which basically has been running since 1979. The first 2 years we sort of screwed around, used an outdoor survival board and didn't really have a campaign. And by 79, we had really formalized it where we had long-term characters and we were, you know, doing things like trying to build castles and that kind of thing. And where we lived was fairly small town. And the only thing we could get was a very few amount of TSR things, but for some reason we could get all the Judges Guild stuff. And so, so we had the Judges Guild, the hex maps and that kind of thing. And we used that sort of as the basis of our campaign. And then of course I drew my own. And so I had two continents. I had the Judges Guild continent on one side of the Big Earth, which is actually pretty small. If you look at the dimensions on the Judges Guild Wilderlands, it's not a very big place. It's about the size of Europe. And then I had my own world on the kind of the other side of that. But Rappanathic was in the Judges Guild piece of the world. It was in the Elfin lands. The name itself comes from, everyone think there's something called Rappanathic or something. It was like a giant village in someplace in the Wilderlands. That's not where the name came from. The name came from, a really obscure indie publication from the mid-70s called First Encounter. It was a little magazine that I think they had 6 or 7 issues and then went out of business. And one of the things that was in a First Encounter book, and I think it was in issue 3, but I can't remember for sure. I have a set of them up in the warehouse, was they had Old Dwarvish. So they had the language for Old Dwarvish, and Rappan meant dungeon and Athuk meant grave. And so it became the Dungeon of Graves, Rappanathic. And that was taken from, the First Encounter, fanzine thing that was, I've only seen one for sale on Facebook ever. Let me put it on the Facebook marketplace. I did see one for sale, which was like, oh my God, I've got those, you know. But it was a really small indie press thing that was, like I said, probably 77 or 78 is when that came out. They're unobtainium. I mean, you never see these things. It's like trying to get Alan Weasel magazines. You can't find them. Anyways, that's where the name came from, because it was the Dungeon of Graves. We played in it in college so much, along with the sort of air trend line going. But they were always adventuring in Rappahannock that I just wrote a whole bunch more levels. And the party themselves they befriended the goblins, so they were going around actually on missions to like rescue the trapped goblins from different levels and stuff. Of course, they were at war with the evil priests, but the goblins don't like the evil priests that much anyway. They made friends with Max the Odiug, and you know, then there's the shit monster was one of the big guys.
Okay, so things. I'm not gonna lie, the whole my Dungeon Plunger channel, like the name of my show, was big time inspired by that first level.
That's by Dungy.
Yeah. So that's funny. Please don't sue me.
No, it's fine. Yeah, I mean, he's been sort of a fun foil, because he moves really slow, right? So if you get it's kind of like the Austin Powers thing where the bulldozer is going at the guy, and he's like, no, you know, 5 minutes later he's like, no, and then the class, you know, Dungy only moves at like, you know, 15 feet per round. If you can't get away from it, you're an idiot.
That's hilarious.
But it's the biggest thing I can say about playing in Rappahannock, at least how I run it, is, again, you learn very early to be objective based, to hide or get the hell out of Dodge as quick as you can. So if you're going to go and you know you're going after the Zelkor and you found where his lair is, whether, you know, through research or rumors or whatever, you know, you're not going to want to fight a bunch of other stuff on the way there. Now, you might clear your path there and then leave and come back a week later with more resources and then go after the lich, right? Or go after, in this case, the wizard specter, right?
Right.
But he's nasty, you know, and that's the reason you don't go down the well with Zelkor, right? The rest of the level's not that bad, but it's got the ninth level wizard specter with two iron golems in it, you know, behind, you know, big time secret doors. But that's the thing is where, you know, consulting sages has always been a big deal in my game. There's a whole section on this particular topic in the Game Master's Guide, by the way. You know, how do you gather information? You find rumors out in taverns. They're going to be, you know, this is the ways you do it and the roles you need to make to get them there. You consult sages, you know, there are some divination spells, but very darn few really that'll get you a lot of information. You can consult libraries, because there are libraries, you know, Library of Alexandria type things scattered amongst the Lost Lands. The big ones actually in Sword of Air, where if you don't do your homework and you go into that first dungeon, you're a grease spot. You know, if you hadn't gone to the big library to research stuff, you don't even have any clue what you're going to be facing. You know, so that to me, that was, you know, the information gathering thing is the reason there's hundreds of rumors about Rappahannock, is because you can go gather a lot of information and then know things. And it allows for smarter play and focused play on objective type stuff. So we want to go destroy the evil temple. Okay, where is this thing? Can we find it? And maybe they locate it. And then, you know, okay, this is what we face there now. What do we think about? How do you deal with this kind of monster that we encountered and had to run away from?
Right.
And the answer for Zeb a couple sessions ago was the Myconoids. He just threw a fireball at him, which was really unfortunate, because they wanted to be friends, right?
Oh, that's too funny.
Zeb fireballed him. You know, so they joke about the, you know, what's the best spell for a fifth level wizard? And, you know, it has a pie chart, right? And it's like blue and red and green and everything else. And it's like red says fireball and blue says fireball, but in blue, and green says fireball. Yeah, I could be in trouble today because Helen just got her second shape change too. She plays the druid. She can shape change twice now, which is problematic if you look at the druid spell list, because they can fly in as a bird, turn into a human, cast a hell spell, and then fly out as a bird. There's nothing you can do about it. The idea of playing it smart and not like you're not trying to clear a level on a MMO game. And that's really the best advice I can give anybody on running any kind of mega dungeon type thing.
See, I feel like that's where the disconnect for me was with the third edition Pathfinder version of Rappanathic, because it feels like the characters are super optimized for combat. And that's essentially what it comes down to, is just chopping up stuff. And it, I mean, that's
pretty much. That's judgment on who plays what, right?
Exactly.
That's just not the way I play.
Right. And so I felt like, I was like, man, I'm like, this would be a totally different game, like a totally different thing if you're playing it more the way I feel like it was intended to be played. Yeah. And so that I was super curious about. And then the other thing, so there's this whole outside hex crawl area, and there's the pathway that goes north and south along the water. So where do your players base themselves out of when they're like, do they teleport to there, or do they have to have a home base nearby? Like, how
not
does
yet, because Zeb's not knife level yet, but but at some point they probably will. They have to travel overland a lot. That's the comment I made earlier about the Mass Morph spell, is because they have to travel a lot. Because what Mass Morph does for you is it gets you out 100% of your nighttime encounters. You just cast it every day. They go to sleep, they rest, they get up in the morning. If nothing's trying to eat their the illusion that's them in the trees, they just keep traveling. And so they only have to deal with 50% of the wandering encounters, and they're usually at daytime. They use the same thing in the dungeon, and they turn into giant mushrooms or whatever when they need to rest. So a lot of it's just resource management, and they travel a lot. And they, right now, I mean, primarily my campaign, my main play happens along the Sinnar coast, sort of on the map running from, you know, the Desolation Wastes and, you know, where the ruined city of Zen is, down to about where Barrakis and Rappanathic are located. Right. Because that's just sort of honestly, that's where we played 90% of the time in my campaign over the years. There have been some exceptions to that. I had a group for about 4 years that was pretty regular. Some of them are still players, but not all of them, where they were really into, you know, they had a boat, man, and they were sailing the seas and exploring islands and doing stuff like that. And that was a completely different style of campaign, but they basically were, you know, once they're about fourth level and they captured this boat, you know, they basically wiped out some pirates and stole their ship. And, you know, then they upgraded it a little bit and spent some money on, you know, better stuff and hired a crew. And then they sailed around the world for, you know, for 30 or 40 game sessions. And so that was kind of.
So is that the map that you're using now, is the one
Lost Lands?
The Lost Land maps? Okay. So, all right, cool. So that's like really your campaign.
Yeah.
Okay. Interesting.
So on Wednesday night, I use the Judges Guild maps. Sunday's Lost Lands and Wednesday's Wilderlands.
So one of the things, like, I have struggled to run a mega dungeon. I ran Barrow Maze a little bit. Yeah. I feel like I could use some advice, and I feel like other game masters out there who want to run a mega dungeon. How do you run a mega dungeon so that it doesn't get monotonous?
Well, let's see. What did I say in my book? Let me just pull some stuff up. I mean, a lot of it is you have to treat it almost like a big city, right? And so it's a city with more hostile things. And so what are you trying to accomplish what are the players trying to do by going into the dungeon? Are they just trying to bash stuff and get rich? And maybe that's okay. I think that would get pretty monotonous, certainly for my players, because that's not how they're used to doing it. But let me see if I can find anything about what I wrote. So let me just do this, and I'll post this to you, and you can post this any place you want. So it's allowed. People are allowed to see this. And even though it'll be in the book in a better, more English friendly version than this one, because this is the unedited version of it. But I can give you this. So this is what I wrote about the topic. And, you know, it talks about, you know, what is a dungeon crawl? You know, what are the kind of the aspects of that different thing, and how to avoid some of them? You know, so there's less role-playing opportunities, obviously, but you can still try to meet stuff. So a good example of this in Rappanathic. So Helen, being the druid, Helen Cook, decides that they want to find a way into Rappanathic, but they don't want to go down the well. and they don't want to go through the mausoleum because everybody's doing that. And so there's got to be a better way in because they've heard the rumor. They did some homework and they've heard rumors that you can travel rivers and there's cave entrances and stuff. And so she went out and did a locate animals looking for river otters or, and then she didn't get any of those because I rolled. And then she's like, well, what about muskrats? And I'm like, roll on that. Okay, sure. Yeah, you find some muskrats. So she meets Jimmy and Johnny Muskrat. And she meets Jimmy and Johnny Muskrat and she starts talking to him with speaking animals. And she's like, if you guys find any caves, you know, are there any places that are big where like people like us could be in them and stuff? And she makes a parlay check with these things and gives them some food and talks to them. It's friendly. And she basically makes friends with these two muskrats. Well, the two muskrats talk about, yeah, we went in this river cave and went inside this place and our friend Freddie turned into a rock. And she's like, what do you mean? She goes, yeah, he was a minute ago. He was Freddy. And then we licked him and he tasted like stone. And she's like, ah, something turns things to stone. So they had him show him how to get in there, but they already knew they were kind of going in to deal with something like a basilisk or a cockatrice. It ended up being a basilisk. But, and then they rescued, you know, Freddy the muskrat and had him and took him back to the temple, which was run by my daughter's retired character, and had him turned back into flesh. And so now Helen's got three pet muskrats and they do a lot of scouting for her and stuff like that. But she'll, they'll go look for stuff in the dungeon to sort of give them a warning about whether something's there. Cause the monster's not necessarily going to go after a little swimming rat. Right.
Right.
And then they made friends with the displacer beasts on level 3A actually.
Really?
Yeah. Wow. The bard pulled off a miraculous roll and speak with animals. And they, you know, the displacer beasts are looking at these guys. They got like 15, 20 people, right? Cause they've got henchmen and stuff like that. And they're high level. They would, and the displacer beasts are like, yeah, I don't know if we want to, they didn't really want to fight them because they might've won. But on the other hand, you know, half of them or more are going to die. And they're a neutral creature. So, you know, why can't you talk to them? Well, they did. And so now they, you know, basically they pay rent by bringing, by basically lowering cows down into the dungeon to the displacer beast. So they bring livestock in, to, you know, maintain their relationship, but they've got a safe camping spot with a bunch of displacer beasts.
That's amazing.
And they got warned about the black pudding in the bottom of the thing, you know? And so they were able to avoid that. They haven't figured out how to kill it yet because it's underwater. Right. So they, you know, it's in the pool. But they've done a lot of they fought and killed Zelkor. We did that. That was a battle they had over Christmas because they wanted my son and my godson to be home because they play a high level fighter and a high level paladin. And so they ended up with, you know, a couple extra beefcakes. But they knew what they were going after. You know, they'd done their homework and they were pretty sure they knew. You know, it's one of those things. They opened the door. They saw the iron golem. Zeb cast wizard lock and ran away.
Okay.
Okay, we're gonna go back there, but not until we're one higher level, and we have, and basically not until John and Rocco get home from college. And yeah, 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 adding 14 levels of fighter to the group made a big difference because both those guys are seventh level. And yeah, I mean, so does that answer the question? I mean, I could,
yeah, talk, no, that's
week about this, but
no, I think that's great. So I guess just to close out. So like I said earlier, the focus of the show is to help GMs become better GMs. What kind of like general advice would you offer the newbie or the veteran game master?
You bet. So I promised I'd tell the Iron GM story.
Oh, and yes. I forgot to mention that.
This actually relates to the biggest piece of advice I'll give anybody. So I'll tell the story and then I'll say what the advice is.
Perfect.
So I participated in the Iron GM for the East Coast competition at a convention about 4 years ago. Lou Agrest is an old friend of mine and he asked me to do it. And all my business partners were ready to strangle me because they're like, look, if you win, people will be mad. And if you lose, we look like idiots. Right. I finished second, which was perfect. And the thing about that competition is everybody else had they had Dwarven Forge stuff and they had miniatures and they had all these props and noisemakers. And I had these two dice. Okay. And that's all I ever bring to a game are those two dice and a rule book usually. What I did for that adventure was I just said, there are no rules and your people, and let's play as if you were people. And then they gave you three keywords. And so I had to, I think it was plague, fish, and I can't remember, apocalypse or something. And so I did an adventure where you were basically these people and you had a weapon and stuff like that, but you were trying to figure out that the Sahagin were poisoning the water, creating this red tide, and it was destroying the village and everybody was getting sick and dying. And you had to go in and destroy this evil altar and stop the plague from spreading. Right. And we played for about 4 hours and it was just really improv. And so that relates to the exact thing I was going to say about running a game. Whenever you're a DM and you pre-plan a whole bunch of stuff, man, and you got the whole thing set in your mind, this is how it's going to go and everything else. And the players get in there and they're all right. They just need to go right. And they go, we're going to go left. And you're like, oh shit, I hadn't considered that. Or we're not going to go there. We're going to go someplace else. You know, that sounds like it sucks. We don't want to do that. So we're out. You have to, first of all, you can't really railroad people where they hate it. Right. There's no joy in being railroaded. And so you got to let the players have agency with what they decide they're going to do. And you got to let them be part of the story and let them tell the story. Right. Your job is to react to it, but you have to be a little nimble. And so whenever you plan something, unless you're absolutely certain that they're going to do it, like I'm pretty sure today they're going to go fight the boss in the end of the Blood Moon adventure, because they explored all the rest of the dungeon. They've gathered all the pieces of information they needed to gather. They've figured out the puzzles and they've figured out some, you know, a way to fight the thing. Right. And they're pretty sure it's a vampire. I'm not going to give any spoilers on whether it's a vampire or not, but they think it's a vampire. And we'll see if it is, but anyway, you got to be nimble on your feet, and you got to let the players decide what they want to do. You can't railroad them. And so what I usually do, you know, I do a little bit of prep and I do stuff like this, right? This is about as fancy as my prep gets for an entire game session. And what this piece of paper allowed me to do was either have them go hex crawl away and find a cave that's got some stuff in it, or if they don't go in the cave, great, they just keep hex crawling, or it allowed them to go into a dungeon that they knew about already that I was pretty sure they wanted to go in, because that's where you find things like treasure, which is what gets you experience points. And I ended up being right about the dungeon. And so then that dungeon became one of the ones I just put on my Patreon, because it was for my home campaign. It's what they were planning. And, but you have to don't think that the players are going to do what you want them to do, because they're not. And you have to have different options that you at least prepare a little bit for in case they do go left when you thought they were going to go right. So that's my biggest advice as a DM. Let's see if I said anything else in my book, because I probably did. So the other thing I do that I would recommend, as a dungeon master, you do with your group is ask them what types of things they want to do. Do they want to explore the wilderness, or do they want to go in a dungeon, or do they want to, and I call this my session zero. We usually have like a 45 minute meeting or whatever the week before we're going to initiate either new characters, or kind of when we have a big grand finale, like when we finish the adventure today, if they go fight the boss and kill him, we'll have a discussion either at the end or at the beginning of the next session about, okay, what do you guys want to do next? You know, because I need to do a little bit of prep. I don't need to do a lot of prep because I've been there, done that a couple of thousand times probably, but I need to do a little bit of prep. So what is it you want to do? And then if they don't really want to go in a dungeon, then I don't design a dungeon. If they want to go in Rappanathic, then we'll go play in Rappanathic. If they don't, because they actually told me that they wanted to go play in Rappanathic about, I don't know, 10 sessions ago. And then they sort of got sick of that. And then they wanted to go wilderness travel for a little bit. But by providing an opportunity to your players to have some say in like, what are we going to have for our adventure? It makes them more engaged and lets them participate in what I call the art of the storytelling.
Okay.
And so don't assume you have to do it all. You just have to provide the stage, man. Let the players be the actors.
Yeah, that's fantastic. Perfect.
And remember, it's a role-playing game, R-O-L-E. A lot of people forget that.
Yeah.
They treat it like R-O-L-L. And, you know, no judgment on that. I mean, like,
yeah,
I said,
no, of course not.
One of my best friends is a murder hobo extraordinaire, man. If he doesn't kill five things a game, he's disappointed. But again, that particular game at the convention, when I know Mike and his buddies are all going to be there, I run a really combat heavy adventure, you know, because that it caters to what they want.
Right. So like knowing your players.
Yeah, yeah. And so, you know, he'll always call me before he signs up for one of my games. And he's like, like I said, is this the Mensa test or is the brawl? And I'm like, we can make it the brawl one. I'll make that one the brawl one. Tell all your friends, you guys can show up for that. And then, you know, I do the Mensa test the day before or the day after. But
this has been fantastic, Bill.
Yeah, it's fun.
I'm happy
to come on anytime.
Thanks.
And, you know, just let me know. And I like doing stuff like this. And, as you can tell, I'm a very enthusiastic, excited gamer.
Yes.
I love the game, and it's been a huge part of my life for almost 50 years. So, I mean, there's a reason I still do this stuff.
Yeah, well, for sure. I can sense the excitement and the enthusiasm, and I really, really appreciate, you know, you coming on the show, and I feel like you've shared some really great advice, and I could listen to you talk for hours, man. So definitely at some point I'd love to have you on in the future. Yeah. So the Kickstarter ends June 1st, 2025.
Please, everybody go out there and at least get us to $60,000, because I want little Stevie to have to write a book.
All right. We're going to make it happen.
Yeah. I think we're pretty close. I think we're going to be there soon. So,
all right. Perfect. So unless there's anything else you wanted to end with, that's where we'll leave it.
Nope, that's it. And like I said, I'd happy to be on anytime. If anybody has questions, ask them on the Kickstarter. I usually look at it at least once a day. Check out my Patreon. Again, it's free. And you can ask me questions there too. And I check the messages and everything there every day. That's pretty much it. And there will be a lot of support for this rule system from me, whether it comes just from me or whether it comes from Frog God Necromancer. We haven't decided yet, because we're at our core, we really are a 5e company. And so I don't want to take resources away from that. Because our company still has to make money, or people don't get paid.
Fair.
And I think the 5e market, in whatever shape it's in, is still a bigger market than the OSR market. So until that changes, well, other than maybe Shadow Dark, right?
Yeah.
But until that changes, just on the business side, I may be doing my own thing in addition to, not to say that my books won't get translated into 5e and done as a 5e book, but I may do first releases just as Necromancer's game books, and then kick them to the editors and let them do their 5e voodoo with them.
Well, all of that will be in the show notes, so people will have direct links to get to that. And I encourage everybody to back and to join the Patreon.
Yeah, and thanks again for having me on. It's been great. And the dogs barking tell me that my players are arriving, so I probably better go.
All right, dude. Thank you so much.
All right, man. Yep. Thanks again, Jason.
Greetings, listener. This is I, Hector, the real Dungeon Plunger. Not that milk drinker Jason. We in the dungeon always appreciate whatever love you can give us. So please, share the podcast, send your messages, and do anything that will unclog our algorithm. We really appreciate it. Plungers up!